days beyond recall, when on the world the mist began to fall, out of the dreams that roll in a happy throng, lo, to our hearts love sang an old sweet song. And in the dusk where fell the firelight gleam,
welcome to episode 91 of the Blooms and Barnacles podcast, where we talk about all things relating to James Joyce's Ulysses. I'm Dermot.
And I'm Kelly. How are you today, Dermot?
Hot and sweaty.
All right. I don't think it's too bad.
I just had a coffee. That wasn't a good idea.
Okay. Well, we are very happy to be back in your ears after an extended absence, but we are back with lots of Blooms and Barnacles stuff in the near future, this podcast being but one of those things. If this is anyone's first episode, we are a blog as well as a podcast, and I am nearly finished with a new blog post about Dante, so that'll probably be out the same week as this podcast, and so keep an eye on that on our social media if you follow us there, or at our website,
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Next up, Dermot is the artist for our podcast, and he's done some lovely artwork for this episode. Would you like to tell us some about it?
Yes, it's Bloom in the Turkish Baths. So it's the scene where he's having naughty thoughts about how he might pass the time in the bathtub. And for this cartoon, I actually did a bit of image mining and trying to find the Turkish Baths reference. Is there any internal, like, visual reference? Couldn't find really anything that I could use. So it's sad, really. There's no one thought fit to take photos of the interior. But I did a lot of stuff of the exterior to figure out, like, exactly where it was in relation to Sweeney's Chemist, because it's just on the same building block at Lincoln Place. And I found in one of the photographs, sure enough, there's, like, the only part of the building or, like, complex that survives are two old pillars. Mm. And there's that big banal red to the right of Sweeney's at the end of that block. There's that big boring modern red building.
Yeah.
And there are those two very tall, old looking pillars. And there's a big gateway that goes into, like, a back car park. Those are the only component that still survives of that complex.
I'll have to look for that the next time I walk by there.
Yeah, it's interesting because it gives you, like, a kind of a footing for where the thing was.
Okay.
And I've said, oh, now I get it. And then there's another photograph where you can see the corner of what's now Kennedy's. And they had Roman numerals for the building number XXXII instead of 32. Mm-hmm. Other than that, you can clearly see Kennedy's and Finn's Hotel. And you go, oh, now I know where it was. Okay. It was just right there. Yeah,
Kennedy's referred to as Conway's in Ulysses, which is the section we'll be reading from today. Okay, well, the next time I walk by there, I'll have to look for it.
Yeah.
All right. We've got a few shout-outs before we move into the main text for today. First of all, we want to say a big thank you to everyone who's donated to our show. And today in particular, we'd like to say thank you to
Ken Quapis. I hope I got your name right. It might be Quapi or some other pronunciation. Apologies for getting it wrong.
Thanks, Ken.
Kenji Hayakawa as well, our good friend.
And thank you to all of our recurring donors. If you'd like to help out with a donation, you can do so at
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Yep, just click the donate button at the upper right-hand corner if you like what we're doing. And if you'd like to help out in a non-monetary way, you can recommend us to a friend or leave a review over at Apple Podcasts. And if you leave a review, we will read it. Finally, if you'd like to keep up with all of our posts and podcasts and Dermot's lovely artwork, you can subscribe to our email newsletter that will come out to you once a month with the links of all the new stuff in it and usually some previews of upcoming things. And finally, if you send us an email, we do enjoy it. We got one recently from a reader named Win Kwan. I think what I liked about this is that it reminded me of a post that I had more or less forgotten that I had written. And I just wanted to share some of their letter. Could you read that, Dermot?
Sure. Thanks so much for providing the details on Averroes and Maimonides. One thing that struck me, which shows Joyce's multidimensional genius, is that the passage is alliterative. A mathematical metaphor with lots of M's. When you read it aloud, it sounds wonderful. Another fascinating twist is that Morris dance, along with most folk dances, have a mathematical angle. They involve patterns that can be described and understood in mathematical terms.
And I just like that little insight. Do you remember that post, Dermot?
Oh, yeah, very well. Yeah.
You remember drawing the guys dancing on the book with mathematical
symbols? Yeah, no, from my other project that I've been searching material for it involved a lot of reading about Islamic history, and Moorish Spain came up, of course, quite a bit in that. And I apologize for any clinking you hear in the background. We have yet another cat.
Yes, if we have any people who watch Owen Jones's YouTube channel, his live stream was killed by a cat today, leaving his guests alone awkwardly on the Zoom as he tried to fix the audio setup. Cats hate audio.
Pulled out all of his audio cables, and we can relate to that. All
right. Yes, because we have one trying to do it right now while I'm expertly restraining him.
He'll settle.
Okay. All right, he's moving off into the distance.
He's a Portland stray that we brought to Ireland with us.
Oh, Nibbler's much more than that. Yeah. He's provided musical accompaniment to some of our earlier podcast episodes. And currently is registering his disgust with the fact that we would do anything other than look at him. Anyway, he's taking a bath now, which is great thematically for our podcast today. So let's move into that. Because, Dermot, today we are finally finishing Lotus Eaters, a relatively short and simple chapter that I feel like we've spent around 7 years on. So if you're following along at home, we'll be reading from pages 85 and 86, which are the page numbers in my edition, the 1990 Vintage International Edition. And this will be our last chance to look for lotuses. Dermot, do you remember what the lotuses symbolize?
Yeah.
Or what I mean when I say lotus?
It's from the Odyssey, right? It's people who consume drugs to kind of opiate themselves. And so the theme throughout the chapter has been anything that induces slight changes of consciousness. Mm-hmm. So smells of tea or coffee or any kind of flower growing thing, that kind of thing.
Yeah, anything that has produces a narcotic quality.
Yeah.
We've got a couple in this, so see if you can spot them. And finally, since it's been a while, we've had three episodes between this and our previous book discussion episode, because June was a big month for us. I thought it'd be nice to have a little last time on Blooms and Barnacles. Do you remember what the last section was about?
It's been so long, I cannot remember.
We talked about Sweeney's Pharmacy and about Victorian-era soap ads.
Okay.
So, Bloom had just gone into Sweeney's. Do you remember what he did in Sweeney's?
Well, yeah, he buys the soap, of course.
Yeah.
And the soap ads being heinously racist at the time.
Yeah. Yes, which didn't necessarily make it in. Although there's a mention of Pears soap here. There's a little crossover last time. You want to know what we're talking about? Go and check out the episode entitled Chemist Rarely Move. So Bloom now is finished in the chemist, and he stepped back out onto the streets. So, if you could read our first passage.
He strolled out of the shop, the newspaper baton under his armpit, the cool wrappered soap in his left hand. At his armpit, Bantam Lyon's voice and hand said, "Hello, Bloom. What's the best news? Is that today's? Show us a minute." Shaved off his moustache again, by Jove. Long, cold upper lip. To look younger. He does look balmy. Younger than I am. Bantam Lyon's yellow black nail fingers unrolled the baton. Wants a wash too. Take off the rough dirt. Good morning. Have you used Pear's soap? Dandruff on his shoulders. Scalp wants oiling.
Thank you, Dermot. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Bloom's been very mean about this poor dirty man. but he's probably filthy, all right. So the newspaper baton, so he's ruled. So is this, I'm guessing Bantam Lyons is, because I have no idea who he is. So I'm assuming he's going to look up horse racing or some sporty stuff like that. That seems straight enough. I mean, it's obviously the only thing that makes it hard to parse is just the usual, you know, unconventional, like, absence of quotation marks. Mm-hmm. Long, cold upper lip, ooey.
So do you think Bloom likes his shaven face?
No.
Yeah.
No. I think he thinks he's doing it for vanity. And that younger than I am is a nice bit of begrudgery too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I took that younger than I am to say, like, he's done it to look younger, but he doesn't look younger than Bloom's.
Mm. Well, I know when I shave, I don't like having a beard, and I just let it grow because I don't like cutting my face when I shave. That's always a relief when I do, and I always look younger. Like, it's noticeable.
You look very handsome shaven, and you look very ruggedly handsome, stubbly. All right, Bantam Lyons. He's basically just a guy that from Bloom's social circle. He was a character in the Dubliner short story Ivy Day in the Committee Room, so you can spot him there as well. McCoy. Do you remember McCoy?
Oh, God. I should.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're going to have to remind me.
He is the guy who stopped Bloom earlier on his way out of the post office.
Right, when he was being very covert about the pen pal, his fancy lady.
And McCoy in that scene had mentioned that he had just seen lions in Conway's, which is today called Kennedy's, which you and I have both spent some time in.
Fantastic place.
Mm-hmm. So McCoy is just coming out of the pub in that scene, and he's seen lions in there. So we get a little preview. That is during the scene where Bloom is watching the woman climb onto the jaunting car, which you did a little cartoon of.
Yep.
So this is Bandom Lions. All right, let's read the next bit.
I want to see about that fridge horse that's running today, Bantam Lion said. Where the bugger is it? He rustled the pleated pages, jerking his chin on his high collar. Barber's itch. Tight collar, he loses hair. Better leave him the paper and get shut of him. You can keep it, Mr. Bloom said. Ask it. Gold cup. Wait, Bantam Lions muttered. Half a mo. Maximum the second. I was just going to throw it away, Mr. Bloom said. Bantam Lions raised his eyes suddenly and leered weakly. What's that? His sharp voice said. I say you can keep it, Mr. Bloom answered. I was going to throw it away that moment. Bantam Lions doubted an instant, leering, then thrust the outspread sheets back on Mr. Bloom's arms. I'll risk it, he said. Here, thanks. He sped off towards Conway's corner. Godspeed, scut.
So what do you think?
Does not like this man one little bit.
He thinks he's gross, I think.
Yeah.
Well as annoying.
He's also more interested in betting on horses than anything like personal or personable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so describe to me what goes on in this scene.
Oh, so this guy's, he wants to look up a horse, the odds on the horse. Doesn't want to pay for a paper, so he catches one off of Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems pretty abrupt about it. You know, give me the paper, I want to look up. Blah, blah. Sounds like a gambling addict. Probably used to losing. So he's gone into the bookies to put a bet on him. So he sped off towards Conway's corner. So, we're outside the baths, I assume.
They're outside of Sweeney's.
Sweeney's. So outside of Sweeney's, so I know exactly where we are. And then Kennedy's or Conway's is right across the big three-way intersection thing. And down to our left would be the baths. So he sped off towards Conway's corner. So I'm assuming on his way to a bookie's office.
You're on the right track, Dermot. This little meeting here is a... seems like, I guess to use a pun, kind of a throwaway scene.
Mm-hmm.
But this is actually a very significant moment.
Oh.
As you said, old Bantam here wants to check the odds for the horse race of the day, which would be the Ascot Gold Cup. And the horses Scepter and Zinfandel are the favorites. At least that's according to the June 16th edition of the Freeman's Journal from that year. So these are all real horses. It's a real horse race. It really did take place on that day.
Mm-hmm.
Bloom, as we will see, has absolutely no interest in horses, which really kind of sets him apart from his peers because they are very interested in the horses. All Bloom is interested in this scene is trying to lose Bantam even quicker than he did with McCoy. And he kind of said, he looks Bantam up and down. He thinks he looks gross. And so you have to think, too, Bantam is taking this newspaper from him with his big, greasy, dirty hands. Mm-hmm. And Bloom's like, you can just keep it. Mm-hmm. I was going to just throw it away. You can keep it.
Because
he doesn't want the soiled paper back.
Yeah.
So he tells Bantam to keep it, also thinking he can, you know, get out of there quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bantam interprets this as a betting tip,
right.
Because there is a horse, and again, this was in real life as well as in Ulysses, and if you're familiar with Ulysses, this you already know how this all shakes out,
mm-hmm.
But there's a horse in the race called Throwaway,
mm-hmm.
literally named Throwaway, so Bantam interprets this as Bloom giving him some kind of insider tip that he's passing on. Maybe he learned it from his, you know, co-workers at the newspaper or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Bantam thinks is that Bloom's saying, take the paper, wink, wink. I was going to throw it away, wink, wink. And that's why it says, what does it say here? Bantam Lions doubted an instant, leering, because he's thinking like, throw away, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his throwaway had 21-1 odds. And he says, I'll risk it. And then he, yeah, I think you're right. He's off to the the bookies. And then the last phrase there from Bloom's mind is Godspeed, scut.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
A little scut would be not a good thing. Like, I would think about like a scrawny person or somebody who's not quite like physically dignified.
Yeah, it's not a kind thing that he's saying.
Yeah, like scutter would be a euphemism for diarrhea. So I don't know if scut is in any way related to that. I couldn't tell you, but it's a little scut. Yeah, like a little fecker, but harsher than fecker.
Let's continue on. Oh, wait, before we do, did you catch any lotuses in that scene?
Oh, I didn't. Let's see here. The only thing I can think would be Pear's soap.
Oh, interesting.
Because it's like a, you know, it's a thing that's not, you know, it's got some chemicals and things in it.
I would have said gambling. That's kind of what I was thinking of.
Course, yeah. Yeah, although I don't know if the modern theory of addiction existed in this time period. Like, would people in this period have associated gambling with narcotics, like Gambling Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous? I don't think that thought process, but maybe so. Yeah,
I would think less for its addictive quality than for its stupefying quality.
Yeah, definitely stupefying.
Yeah, yeah, that's more the angle I'm thinking.
I think gambling addiction is the saddest of all the addictions, to be honest. Okay.
All right, go ahead.
Mr. Bloom folded the sheets again to a neat square and lodged the soap in it, smiling. Silly lips of that chap. Betting. Regular hotbed of it lately. Messenger boy stealing to put on sixpence. Raffle for large tender turkey. Your Christmas dinner for threepence. Jack Fleming embezzling to gamble, then smuggled off to America. Keeps the hotel now. They never come back. Fleshpots of Egypt.
All right. Thoughts?
He really dislikes gambling, yeah, much as I do. Yeah, it's the thing about being back in Ireland, like there's bookies offices all over the place. And I'm sure it was about the same then. I think it would have been as bad then as now. I will say one thing, like if I ever were to gamble, my dad back in the day would occasionally tell me, like he knew a guy that was into horses, like professionally, and occasionally you'd meet him in the pub and he'd give him a tip, and the tips always came true.
Mm-hmm.
And dad really drove me nuts about 16 years ago. I was on the phone. I was in America, he was in Ireland. He told me, oh, he gave me a tip and I put £10 on me and 20-1. It was like this, or 30-1, and he got it and he won. And I was furious. I said, for God's sake. And I didn't put it that politely. He said, the next time that happens, you know, you'd let me know and I'll put in more than 10 or 20. It'll be worth it in that instance and only in that instance. But like this kind of scenario is very real. You know, it's happened to my dad a couple of times.
You're a bit of a Leopold Bloom yourself then.
Oh, very much. Yeah, yeah. You get nothing. You can't, statistically, you just, unless you really know what you're doing, there's no way you can win. There's no way.
Do you remember what the phrase, flesh pots of Egypt, refers to?
Is this a callback to one of his Orientalist dream sequences?
It's a callback to your favorite episode, Proteus, and also your favorite book of the Bible, Exodus. So the idea was after the Israelites left Egypt, they wandered in the desert for 40 years. And at that time, they would complain to Moses and anyone who would listen that they missed the, quote, flesh pots of Egypt, which are basically big pots of you know, mystery meat or whatever they were eating when they were slaves.
Yeah.
And they started to feel like maybe we were better off as slaves in Egypt when we had food to eat.
Right.
Even though now we have freedom, but we're starving. So it's a terrible freedom. Now, God and Moses did not agree with these complaining Israelites. And it's meant to be a stand-in for someone being tempted by false promises.
Okay.
If you remember Stephen's lung stew that he was eating on the cheap, that was when he referenced those flesh pots of Egypt.
Yeah.
All right, why don't you read the next bit?
He walked cheerfully towards the Mosque of the Baths. Remind you of a mosque, red-baked bricks, the minarets. College sports today, I see. He eyed the horseshoe poster over the gate of College Park. Cyclist doubled up like a cod in a pot. Damn bad ad. Now if they'd made it round like a wheel... Then the spokes, sports, sports, sports. And then the hub, big, college. Something to catch the eye.
Okay, thoughts?
So again, we're walking toward the Turkish baths now. Mm-hmm. Anyone reading who doesn't know what the hell we're talking about, because it's long since ripped down. 1970, I think they tore it down. So I was still alive.
We'll put a picture in the show notes.
Yes, but if you can't be bothered or you can't find them, just go to Google, type in Dublin Turkish baths, and you'll see they're really amazing. And they were a little goofy. Like I think they were described as not conforming to architectural norms. but it was novel. It's really a shame it's gone. So I know he's describing some advert poster and he's criticizing it, but I can't visualize it based on that description, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, he's very close to Trinity College, and there's just a poster for the college sports day, and he thinks it's badly designed.
Yeah.
So you could look at that as advertising as another Lotus.
Yep.
And we'll talk about sports as a Lotus before we're done here as well. The horse racing and gambling kind of falls into that.
I think so, yeah.
The thing I want to pick out here is, yes, that Turkish bath that was at 11 Lincoln Place, and it was also known as a hammam, which is a traditional name for a Turkish bath. And this would be, now, I think in Turkey, this would be a steam bath that may or may not include a submerged bath. Mm-hmm. However, when these Turkish baths became popular in the United Kingdom, of which Ireland was a part in 1904, they were used as sort of a popular health treatment. This imported variety was known as a Victorian Turkish bath or an improved Turkish bath, aimed for a drier heat with reduced steam. And the idea was that would cure your various maladies. So the Victorian Turkish bath experience often ended with a plunge into a cold pool. And if you are in the UK in the 21st century, there is a restored Turkish bath in Yorkshire that is apparently quite faithful to the oldies. I will put a link to that on our show notes. So Turkish baths were seen in this era as a place to improve both one's physical health and one's social health. In their heyday, the Lincoln's Place baths offered coffee and tobacco to their patrons, and the even swankier Turkish baths at Stephen's Green offered coffee and tobacco, as well as soup, wine, biscuits, a hairdresser, and a small lending library. So you could get biscuits in your bath. Or some soup. You could eat soup while you are soup. This style of public bath was already going out of style by the end of the 19th century. And the Lincoln Place baths themselves had closed their doors for good in 1901. Though the building lasted into the 20th century.
I presume it was gutted. I think it was used as just a regular business at that point.
We'll talk more about this Victorian bath culture at the end of our show today. I just want to go through these last couple paragraphs here.
There's Hornblower standing at the porter's lodge. Keep him on hands. Might take a turn in there on the nod. How do you do, Mr. Hornblower?
How do you do, sir?
Heavenly weather, really. If life was always like that. Cricket weather. Sit around under sunshades. Over after over. Out. They can't play it here. Duck for 6 wickets. Still, Captain Culler broke a window on the Kildare Street Club with a slog to square leg. Donnybrook Fair more on their line. And the skulls we were a-cracking when McCarthy took the floor. Heat wave. Won't last. Always passing the stream of life, which in the stream of life we trace is dearer than them all. Enjoy your bath now. Clean trough of water. Cool enamel. The gentle tepid stream. This is my body.
Okay. Thoughts?
That's really nice. So I'm
so appropriate for this weekend too.
Yeah, it really is. For those listening in the future, the UK is currently undergoing 42 degree heat wave. Although where we are, it's warm, but not nowhere near like that. We're in the 20s, thank God. But they're having like a 1904 heat wave, which is probably about what we're having now. So Hornblower, I assume, is the doorman or porter.
He's the porter at Trinity College.
Right, right. He says, keep him on hands, might take a turn in there on the nod.
Yeah, basically Bloom thinks he would let him in if he wanted to go in.
Okay.
And watch the sports.
Okay. So they talk about cricket. I don't know anything about cricket, but I can recognize the lingo. Duck for 6 wickets is cricket language. That's all I can tell you. Over after over, like an overs are like,
Is it
like
like an
a,
inning?
yeah, something like that.
Okay.
And out, same thing. He says they can't play it here, so I guess that's a criticism of the local players, it sounds like. Let's see. So Captain Cullora, I presume one of the players, broke a window. So with a slog to square leg, again, more cricket talk. But clearly a throw that was good enough to break a window somewhere. Let's see. That's a beautiful sentence here. Always passing the stream of life, which in the stream of life we trace is dearer than them all. I like
That's
that.
nice.
Yeah, enjoy a bath. And yet, this is my body. That's a little Eucharistic. This is my body. It's in the flesh.
Absolutely,
Yes.
yeah. Which the Eucharist is a lotus.
Yep.
And Joyce, in one of his schema, specifically called out the cricket spectators as lotus eaters.
Okay,
Yeah.
yes.
So, and I think that would expand to sports spectators more broadly.
Yeah.
And Mr. Joyce himself, at least according to his friend Frank Budgeon, who wrote a book called James Joyce and the Making of Ulysses, said that Joyce was apparently quite a fan of cricket back in the day. So that was a. Yep. So Joyce was a big cricket head.
Okay.
All right. This is the last paragraph of Lotus Eaters now.
He foresaw his pale body reclined in it at full, naked, in a womb of warmth, oiled by scented melting soap, softly laved. He saw his trunk and limbs rippled over and sustained, buoyed lightly upward, lemon yellow, his navel, bud of flesh, and saw the dark tangled curls of his bush floating hair of the stream around the limp father of thousands, a languid floating flower.
Assuming that's the most literary description of a flaccid penis you've ever read.
Pretty much.
All right, any other thoughts?
He'd have been a great writer of gay erotica too. Another alternate history, James Joyce. Yeah. So yeah, again, more. Let's see here. Fairly cleanly written. Like you can't really get too confused by that. Lemon yellow again. Little. I guess that's another callback to the soap. So, but there's no description of the environment. It's like it goes right to just a description of him, his body in the water.
Yeah.
It's not talking about the, it's not describing the interior in any way at all.
No, it's not much of an architectural description in that way.
Yeah, he's no
But
Mervyn Peake here.
notice he said he foresaw. So it's just him imagining this. This is his imagination.
Okay.
So what's
So he's not
notable to
there
him?
yet.
Yeah. He's
Yes,
not
I
there yet.
see. Yes, I see.
All right. So we see Bloom in the bath, a big floaty lotus. The, hot, steamy bath is a lotus as well. And speaking of Frank Budgeon and his book about Ulysses, he Budgeon himself did a series of drawings of different scenes from Ulysses, and one he did is like a bird's eye view of Bloom in the bath, and I'll include that sketch in our show notes so you can see it. So, earlier, as Bloom was leaving Sweeney's with his soap, he had thought about masturbating in the bath in this earlier passage, but he doesn't. We'll return to this. And now, because it happens off screen, there are various theories about that, but overall, I think Bloom uses the bath as a bath. What I do want to talk about right now, we'll return to his bathsturbation. What I want to talk about right now is Victorian bath culture. Let's go back to those improved, quote unquote, Turkish baths. So, a lot of their popularity was due in part to popular Orientalism of the period. Anything from the East sort of seemed mysterious, intriguing. We've done a couple episodes on that in the past, so you can check those out. They all have Orientalism in the title. Bloom, for his part, is quite a robust Orientalist, and since the first page of Lotus Eaters, he has been dreaming of a dolce far niente, reclining sweetly in some eastern paradise. So perhaps Bloom hopes to find a taste of that sweet life inside this imitation hammam. The facade, as you've mentioned, was designed to resemble a mosque, and so it kind of calls to mind a more grounded version of his Orientalist daydream in Calypso. So our pseudo Harun al-Rashid is going to take refuge in a pseudo mosque. So in addition to just kind of having a particular aesthetic, baths like this were also a symbol of middle class respectability. So Dermot loves a class angle on any topic. So let's do this. The Victorian era in Britain and Ireland saw a growth in the middle class, but as it turns out, the middle class is a fairly precarious place to be. So if a middle class person is particularly lucky, they may be able to rise up in the social hierarchy. However, there's plenty of room in that hierarchy for failure, and a slide into poverty is an ever-present and very real danger. And at the turn of the 20th century, reminders of the horrors of poverty would never have been far from sight. Even Bloom, who's now basking in the glory of, middle-class respectability, had opened the same episode by remarking on some of the visible poverty in this neighborhood of Dublin, if you want to reread that section.
By Brady's cottage is a boy for the skins lolled, his bucket of offal linked, smoking a chewed fag butt. A smaller girl with scars of eczema on her forehead eyed him, listlessly holding her battered cask coop. Tell him if he smokes he won't grow. Oh, let him. His life isn't such a bed of roses, waiting outside pubs to bring Da home. Come home to ma, Da.
Right. So Bloom is very aware of his place in the social hierarchy, and the Blooms are sort of lower middle class now, but they've had hard times as well. An aspect of this kind of unmitigated poverty in a city like this too is that epidemics like cholera or typhoid, things that are caused by this just dismal sanitation in the poorest quarters of cities of Dublin, were rife throughout the era as well. And rather than evoke empathy for the poor or maybe inspire some social reforms, instead the society tended to blame the most vulnerable victims, those people experiencing this grinding, inescapable poverty. They were often seen as reckless, intemperate, and lazy, and thus deserving of their low status in life. Since the lower classes were assumed to be unable to control their impulses for immoral vices, the middle and upper classes saw them simply as lacking discipline, and thus they remained poor.
Really good that that doesn't happen anymore today.
No one thinks that way now, in Britain or else, or Ireland America, or elsewhere. Or anywhere else. Yes. So as such, middle classes favored pastimes that would be seen societally as moral. Bathing, since it was immoral to be dirty, because that marked you as a lower class person, bathing was seen as very virtuous, moral, and even rational way to occupy one's free time, as it improves society by improving health. After all, cleanliness is next to godliness. It also created this hard dividing line between what was considered lower class and middle class. It's really no coincidence that the term the great unwashed, used to describe the common rabble, was coined in 19th century United Kingdom. So Bloom has some empathy for those less fortunate than him, right? He's even saying, oh, maybe I should tell him if he smokes, he's not going to grow any taller. And he's like, ah, just let him smoke. His life's not so great. Mm. But I'd say Bloom more or less buys into this class-based morality. As I mentioned, the Blooms are a lower middle class. They've been in precarious situations in the past. But that is all the more reason to outwardly project their class status. So whether that is in a framed print of a tastefully nude nymph, or if that is choosing Davy Byrne's moral pub for your lunchtime repast. So clearly, cleanliness and morality are merged in Bloom's mind as he heads to the bath. Mm. Now, contrary to all this cleanliness and morality, Bloom imagines doing something fairly dirty in the Lincoln Place bath.
Massage. Dirt gets rolled up in your navel. Nicer if a nice girl did it. Also, I think I... Yes, I. Do it in the bath. Curious longing, I. Water to water. Combine business with pleasure. Pity no time for massage.
Okay. So, given that Turkish baths were mainly hot air baths or like steam baths, and I don't think the way Joyce describes it here that that's what he's thinking, but I think it's very gross to jerk off into the bathtub. Mm-hmm. Water to water. Yes, Bloom, but it's not that simple. Especially as a public bath. I don't need to explain to people why this is not a good course of action. But when I'm thinking of, like, the Turkish bath as, like, a steam bath, like, Bloom's plan to masturbate in there only raises more questions. And I think it would be fairly difficult to be discreet. You can't even be under the water doing your thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's better or worse to jizz into a filled bathtub or into a steam bath. Mm-hmm. But both seem worthy of a medal at the Terrible Conduct Olympics. He certainly doesn't think about the unfortunate worker who will have to clean up after his little spooge party. Mm-hmm. We're definitely getting an explicit rating on iTunes for using the word term spooge party as well. Do you have any thoughts on this so far?
It's just gross.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
Right. So, Bloom here is producing a most unholy communion.
Mm-hmm.
Back at All Hallows Church, he had thought to himself,
enjoy a bath now. Clean trough of water, cool enamel, the gentle tepid stream. This is my body.
Or, I'm sorry, that's not an All Hallows Church. He thought that just now as he's walking over there. Mm. Anyway, this is my body. That's what I'm going to focus on here. Bloom will use his newly purchased lemon soap in his near-at-hand bath, right? You called out how the water's described as lemon yellow. Mm-hmm. That's the soap.
Mm-hmm.
And through the power of this ritual ablution, which, you know, Catholics perform ritual ablution, the anointing with holy water as they mm-hmm. enter and leave the sanctuary of the church, this will transubstantiate his soap into a protective amulet for his travels throughout Dublin, which we talked about some of its protective qualities in our previous discussion episode. Bloom, however, is a man of commerce above all things, and he sees the possibility of restorative healing in that which can be bought and sold. So his communion is between himself and the cleansing power of mass-produced soap. The capital M mass-produced salvation of the Eucharist really offers him no protection. Bloom is totally disinterested in Scripture, but he sees the power in the promises of redemption offered in the saving grace of potted meat and the cleansing virtue of Pear's soap, though his soap is not Pear's soap. But he calls the Gospel of Pear's to mind when he's meeting Bantam, maybe to ward him off too. Bloom's mind is so firmly rooted in the material world, so he sort of needs to go through a more powerful cleansing in order to connect with spiritual truth. And the Turkish bath can only cleanse him physically. Let's talk about one final lotus. That one that's floating in the bath there. So the bath acts also as a site of emotional regression. It kind of allows him to metaphorically crawl into a womb. His soap combining with the inert steamy bath is acting as a lemony narcotic inside his symbolic womb.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a lotus-y effect. The bath also casts a sexual spell over Bloom, I think more so than a maternal one. Public baths are a rare space where public nudity is socially acceptable and therefore can take on an erotic quality in a very repressed society where you don't often see a lot of skin.
Mm.
And the sensuality of this atmosphere takes on a feminine quality, I would say, for Bloom. This may be due in part to the Orientalist stereotype of Eastern cultures as feminine. There was even a fear in the Victorian era that spending too much time in Turkish baths might feminize the men who frequented them. But Bloom here is definitely harboring some residual sexual energy from Martha's letter. And so maybe this, instead of a symbolic womb, this is a symbolic vagina into which he has crawled to relieve his pain and insecurity. And that's pretty much where we're going to leave it. Though he doesn't quite achieve, you know, fully what one might in a symbolic vagina, he is able to restore himself just enough to wriggle free from the grip of all the lotuses, like Odysseus before him, and carry on to the next leg of his journey.
Okay.
What do you think?
That's amazing. Yeah, I'm glad he didn't do what he was thinking of.
Yeah, and we might get emails and comments about that, because I know people have emailed me to say they have a different interpretation, but I think sure. he thinks about doing it, chickens out, and then is still feeling pretty charged up by the time he hits Sandy Mount Strand in Nausicaa. And so that's one reason that he masturbates in his pants is because he's really like, yeah, he's been thinking about it all day and he's been repressing and repressing and repressing. Mm-hmm. And he's had a hard, pretty hard day at that point, you know, with the funeral and all the Molly stuff and the stuff with the citizen. And I think he just needs a release. Mm. And I think it's an unethical release, but I do think he has a lot of pent up energy and he expends it on the beach that evening. While you can hear the glorious singing from the mass of the nearby church and the fireworks of the Miris Bazaar. So I guess that's where we're leaving it. Big symbolic vagina.
Yeah.
Okay. Until next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. Your support means the world to us. You can subscribe to Blooms and Barnacles on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Spotify, or any other place you listen to podcasts. You can also stream our episodes at our website, bloomsandbarnacles.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles.com. If you've enjoyed our podcast, you can do one of three things to help support us. Number one, please donate at bloomsandbarnacles.com. The PayPal donate button is at the upper right-hand corner of the page. This helps us pay for coffee and for hosting fees. Two, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice. This helps more people find our show. And three, share us with a friend who you think would enjoy Blooms and Barnacles. Blooms and Barnacles is also a blog. We post new articles and original artwork semi-regularly at bloomsandbarnacles.com. Never miss an update by following us on social media. Search for our group, Blooms and Barnacles Podcast, on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at BarnacleCast. You can also send us an email at bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. We met some of our favorite podcast friends through random emails and social media DMs. We'd love to hear from you too, so don't be afraid to shoot us a message anytime. We'll be back in your feed in 2 weeks. Bye for now.